So, good evening. Tim and I thought that we would talk about gladdening the mind. It's kind of a weird thing to kind of just talk about gladdening the mind, as if you could actually just do that. But there is a practice that is steeped in everything that we do that requires we learn how to cultivate this gladdening of the mind. And this feels a lot like if I were going on a retreat. It feels a lot like the first night of a retreat. I don't know if it feels like that to you guys, but it feels like it's temporary. Like I'm starting something temporary, but eventually I'm going to go back to the place that I'm supposed to be at. It's what it feels like, you know, this kind of temporary thing. But when you go into a retreat, for those of you that either haven't been in or if you know about going into a retreat, there is still that sense, oh, it's just a week. It's kind of temporary. It's not going to be very long. 2 days in, it seems like it's been forever. It feels like it's never going to end. And what you need in order to stay the course in your practice is a gladdened mind, an uplifted mind. And when you do the cultivation of uplifting the mind in the beginning of something, like a retreat, it adds to your capacity to be with whatever arises. And so that's why I think we thought, this would be a new beginning, starting out, talking about, from our perspectives, what this gladdening of the minds would look like. And it's not just a new beginning in general, because we are starting this month with the seven factors of awakening. And in those seven factors of awakening, there is an aspect to it that gladdens and uplifts the mind. So first, some thoughts why I think cultivating this gladdening of the mind is so important in practice. I don't know about you guys, but my friends think, most of my non-practitioner friends, non-Buddhist friends, think that Buddhism is the most heaviest, most weighty spiritual practice in the world. It feels to them that all I am doing is wallowing in suffering and difficulty and pain. And I think it comes from whenever I talk to them, I talk about some difficulty that I was investigating, looking at, and what I saw. But to them, a non-practitioner, it sounds like I'm just wallowing in a lot of sadness, a lot of difficulty, a lot of pain. And I would even venture to say that when I first started practicing, that's what it sounded like to me too. I was just wallowing in a lot of difficulty, a lot of pain, a lot of suffering. And I didn't quite get the gladdening piece because it's not something that was widely talked about in Dhamma. We don't widely talk about it in terms of the basic practices is of Buddhism. We talk about suffering and the end of suffering. We talk about the Four Noble Truths, which begin with this relationship with suffering, and then this looking into the causes of suffering. And everything that it seems like we practice into, even our basic practice, is steeped in working with the hindrances and all the difficulties that are preventing us from feeling this sense of liberation and freedom. And so it seems like it can easily feel like the whole practice is weighted in this kind of suffering and dealing with suffering, in and out of suffering, suffering all the time. But I remember one time reading this article, I think it was by Bhikkhu Bodhi, who said that the Buddha never started with suffering, which is kind of a strange way, because we always start with suffering and the nature of it. But he said that the Buddha would start his Dhamma talk with generosity. And he would start by talking about the give and take of generosity, this gladdening, this way of being a part of life, that you are in it in this gladdened, happy state, this uplifted state, a feeling of generosity. And included in generosity, not the way we use it in the West where it's all tied to dana now, but this idea that there's a generous spirit, an abundance, a sense of possibility and openness to whatever is coming. This not a cautious view, but flinging open the doors wide and stepping out into the world in this much more open, uplifted, positive, moving forward into the future place. The author said that it was either Thanissaro Bhikkhu or Bhikkhu Bodhi, I can't remember which one it was now, but they said that once the Buddha felt like the group was connected to generosity, connected to this uplifted spirit, once they felt uplifted and high, open, positive, then he would talk about renunciation. Because then the mind can hear and understand the nature of renunciation. If the mind is not gladdened and opened and full of this positive energy, you say the word renunciation and it just like drops like lead on top of the person's mind. Like, that's enough. I can't do that. Which is why I think early practitioners or people who don't practice think that this practice is steeped in suffering. But when you gladden the mind, when you think about things like gratitude and appreciation and this uplifted sense of joy and happiness for where we are and what we are and what we are about to embark upon, when you open up your heart into this much wider space of all the possibilities that come, even when you think about coming to a new space, all the possibilities that exist here in this space that didn't exist when we were in Soto, that all of that possibility supports our capacity to take on whatever difficulties also come when you take on a new space. So when I go to a retreat, doesn't matter how long that retreat's going to be, I start gladdening the mind. I start thinking of every positive thing I can think of. I think about my granddaughter and laughing babies. If you guys have, this is just an aside, as a practice note, if you have never looked on YouTube, just put in laughing babies. I don't care how miserable you feel. I don't care where your energy is. Just me telling you about laughing babies, and all of a sudden your energy changes. So when it's sort of like if you're taking on something difficult or something that's new or something that you're not quite sure about, you're stepping into the unknown, then you want to step into the unknown with some laughter there and some joy there and some uplift so that you're better prepared to deal with what it is that you're going to deal with. I think that is why the Buddha could talk about suffering and the end of suffering, why he could talk about the first noble truth, or that ennobling truth, is the idea that there is suffering and there is a cause to suffering and there is a way leading to the end of suffering. And the fact that he could talk about that as a practice, this is what we're going to practice with every day, is because he had gladdened the mind. He had opened his spirit, and that capacity, this uplifted sense of possibility, and then it doesn't matter what comes. So when I start a retreat, that's what I do. I start out by looking for and thinking about everything that's going to make me laugh. Doesn't matter what it is. Make me laugh, make me laugh, make me laugh. Just so happy, happy, happy. That's all I tell myself. If I wake up and I'm feeling grumbly or something's not right about my room, or I don't like the yogi job, I'm like gladdening, gladdening, gladdening. Because I can handle anything when the mind is uplifted. I can handle whatever unknown is out there. And the reason why I think this aspect of gladdening the mind is important to talk about now is because we don't know what challenges is going to befall us in this space. We don't know. We haven't adjusted to it. We don't know what's going to happen. For instance, we have to take the mats downstairs. And tonight it might be great. Oh, getting the mats. Sure, I'll help you. I'll get the mats. We'll bring them all upstairs. No problem. Then maybe 3 months from now, we'll be like, please come help us get the mats and bring them upstairs. We don't know what kind of struggle or frustration or just difficulty that we're going to have in the future. And without a gladdened mind, without an uplifted spirit of joy and possibility, then it begins to wear on us and wane on us. So instead, we want to encourage and inspire you to have this much more uplifted spirit, a much more gladdened possibility of what's available here. First of all, for the North Enders, I know you guys are happy because it's much easier. You can even get off at 95th and come straight down. Roosevelt, it's like much better place to be in. And, you know, at first I thought, it's not the same because I can't walk downtown like I usually do, and all these little things that I used to do to prepare myself to get ready to teach. And I realized when I was coming today, well, yeah, I could still do that. Or I could walk here, catch the light rail, and then walk here. It's the same distance. So there's still this, it's a kind of a figuring it out, but I realized if I hold it in an adventure, it's a different spirit. You guys know I'm fantasy people. I love fantasy movies. I love The Lord of the Rings, and I love The Hobbit. And in The Hobbit, I think this is a really great example where we're at. I don't know how many of you have seen The Hobbit, but in The Hobbit, he is, you know, when he was younger, in his younger days, he was really into kind of like adventurous stuff, but now that he had gotten older, out of the, you know, the waywardness of youth, he was settled into his house and he was steady and, you know, everything was set the way it's supposed to be. And of course the wizard came to him, Gandalf came to him to send him off on this adventure. But he's settled now. You know, he's got his way. He knows how to live. He's special. It's fixed. He's got doilies, which is what they laugh at him about. He's got his doilies and he's set. He doesn't want to do this whole adventure thing. But at some point, when he's in the house, you know, he's basically said, no, 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 I can't do that adventure. I can't do it. So everybody leaves him. And he wakes up in the morning. He's in the house by himself. He's just sort of walking around realizing that there's something non-joyous about being settled and set, about this is the only way and this is the way we're going to do it and then that's it. And there's something uplifting about not knowing, about an adventure, about going on an adventure, being an adventure on this journey, not knowing where you're going, but somehow having this sense that I'm doing it with other people, and we're gonna go do something, and take on this noble search that they were gonna take on. And the idea of not going is what hit him. He takes off out of the house, and he's running down the field, so excited to catch up with the group because he's going on an adventure. That's what I think of what we're doing here. We're just going on this adventure. And it's the journey alone that's going to set the tone of how it's going to be. And I could sit here on this adventure. I could feel this adventure as much as I want. But if you're not with me, it's going to be awfully boring in here. Nora's not here, but I always use her as an example because when I first started doing Capitol Hill, Nora would be there. It would be nobody but me and Nora. And I'm like, Nora, you're going to have to hear the Dhamma talk. She's like, oh, Corey, couldn't we just have a chat back and forth? I'm like, no, you're going to hear the Dhamma talk. But there's something special that she would sit and listen to it. Something special about that. There's something special about a teacher capacity to share the Dhamma, practitioners hear the Dhamma, and that we do this all together, and that we don't do it one of us, we do it all together. So that's my space and time. I'm sure I did not use up your time, Tim. I'm checking, I got a couple of minutes. It's always a little testy if I go first. But I did good. So I guess I just want to close with this this quote from Rumi I heard recently. He said, it's not your job or your responsibility to seek out love. Our job, our responsibility, is just to seek and find all the barriers that prevent us from seeing love. And so that's what I'd like us to think of this new adventure that we're on. We're just looking for the barriers that prevent us from seeing the love that already exists around us. Thank you very much.
Just fine, just fine. You know, the last few days or weeks, there's been a lot of activity getting us moved in here, and just a special appreciation for some of the ringleaders on that process, like Deb and Barbara and Peter. You know, they just did so much work behind the scenes to get things so organized for us to make this shift. Now that we're here, it's really helpful just to rest in that sense of newness. a sense of unfamiliarity that we're bathed in. You know, because soda, we were kind of comfortable with that. We knew how things worked. We knew where the bathrooms were, and everything was all laid out. And everything is different and new here. And that sense of newness, there's actually something very sacred there. There's a mysteriousness that we can rest into. We can relax into that sense of freshness, which is really what the practice is designed to do, is to regain that inherent freshness of vision, to release our preconceptions of how things should be, to actually meet them how they are. And so it's a precious time, that sense of newness. Even in the midst of that newness, there's still something that's still there, the sense of stillness, the sense of quiet that goes us wherever we are, a new country, a new place, a new location. So I just want to say a few words along this gladdening of the mind theme. And it's nice to reflect on this year's theme of hindrances and then the seven factors. And they really are designed to counterbalance each other. Now, it's not something that Tori and I came up with. It's actually in the four foundations of mindfulness, in the last foundation, awareness of the hindrances and awareness of the four foundations. So in our practice, it's really essential to be able to be mindful of the contractions of mind, the hardening of the heart, the patterns of the hindrances. We have to be able to bring that sense of a steadiness of attention, compassion and attention to those. It's equally important for us to be able to meet the lightness of mind, the gladdened mind, as Tweri was speaking of, the sense of the open heart, the clarity of mind. And so the seven factors and the hindrances really are important dovetails of the same relationship with our experience, with our mind. Now often this sense of gladdening does need a little extra boost, a little extra emphasis in our minds. Because I don't know if you've noticed that we tend to be a little biased toward what's wrong in our life, what's wrong in our environment. I mean, you can do, you know, teach 100 people, and 100 people say, that was a wonderful talk. And one person says, that was awful. That's the one that's awful is the one we focus on, because that's our inherent bias. There's this DNA evolutionary genetic component that we have, that our ancestors survived longer if they were worried about things, if they're anxious, if they were jittery and ran away from the least little twig cracking. And the ones who just smelt the flowers and relaxed in the beauty got ate by the saber-toothed tigers, so they didn't pass on their genes. So really our DNA, our nervous system is designed to have this very fast, robust response to stress, to danger. Right? So that's how we're designed. We see a dangerous animal, we run away. And then we're free and we're happy. Now society now, we have all these dangers that were not, that were more amorphous. We look at the internet and we find, you know, in 10 minutes we can find things which just will keep you up all night worrying about. We worry about our past history, we worry about our lives, our health. We can look on the internet and see all those little symptoms mean something dire is happening to our bodies. And it's so easy to get carried away with that contraction of mind. So learning to gladden the mind is so essential to counteract that. And this is really important for our practice, because if we don't tend to this gladdening of the mind, it's natural for us to go into contraction when we meet something that's contracted. Our very mindfulness becomes distorted by that shape of that. In the teacher training that Carrie and I took, Jack Kornfield, one of our main teachers, encouraged us to take this training on working with people with trauma. And one of the things I learned about that was that with trauma, it's this kind of vortex that we tend to get caught into. We start to tap into it, and very quickly, like, we become lost in the memories, lost in the sensations, lost in the thoughts. We lose our ability to connect with the present moment. So this quality of mind happens in small ways and in large ways all the time. When we meet something that's contracted, like the hindrances, it's easy for the very thing that we're looking with to become contracted itself. We become like this tunnel vision. We close down, lose the sense of perspective. This is, again, a very much our evolutionary heritage that we need to learn to work with, learn to find a sense of balance. So learning how to gladden the mind, to come into that sense of broader perspective, is so essential for us to have that clarity of attention, the clarity of seeing, which is ultimately what transforms us. If we don't attend to that, again, our very mind takes on the shape of the fear, of the anger, of the dread. And then everything is colored by that. Our very perception reinforces that quality. Now, the wonderful thing about our attention is that we have a certain level of choice about where we place that attention. And we can actually choose to where to focus. We teach that in the introductory class, kind of in a backdoor way, that we say focus on your breath, and focus on your sensations in your body, and then focus on sound, and kind of go through this whole spectrum of this humanity. What we're teaching is how do you actually change your focus from one thing to another, to realize you can actually change your attention. Right? So when we get caught in that contraction of mind, one way to work with it really in the moment is to choose where we rest our attention, to actually choose where our attention lands. Especially if our attention is landing on something that's making that attention tight and contracted. We're losing that ability to be mindful. We're going into reactivity instead of the quality of a responsive, balanced, compassionate attention. It was a few years ago, I was doing some yoga classes and being kind of a tight body type. I would often be in this pose and the instructor would want me to adjust my alignment. And I had gone too far in the pose. I had no slack in the system. So if I try to adjust, I would fall over. So I had to be able to kind of back out of the pose, get slack in the system, and then go in from a better alignment right from the beginning and not go quite as far. And that's often what we have to do with our attention. We sometimes get in the middle of something that we're just so tight and we try to get loose in the midst of it and it's almost impossible. So learning how to step back and have a broader perspective to come out of that clenching of our attention allows our mindfulness to relax, to become more pliable, be more responsive, and then start to go back into whatever that may be, perhaps a difficult emotion, difficult sensation. That gladdening of the mind is such an essential part of this. So at any given moment, there's multiple things that we can rest our attention on. Right here in this room, you can feel your feet touching the ground, in the sense of the air touching your body, the sound of the freeway in the background, sound of the voice, the light, the different colors in the room, the different textures in the room. All this can be taken in our attention. So learning to shift our attention to something that is able to calm the attention, rest the attention is so helpful. Often what happens when we get caught in that contraction of mind is we shift into this realm of time. We shift into the past, you know, thinking about the remorse, the regret, the things we wish we had done differently, or the fantasy of that beautiful experience. Or we shift into the future and what the future might hold, both its beautifulness and also its dread. This shifting of attention comes back into not the past or the future, but what's right here? What's right in front of me? What's available in this very moment? This is something that should not be abstract. It's something that should be very tangible to everyone listening. Can we touch into the breath? Touch into the body? Noticing that when you choose to connect with this present moment's experience, there is a certain level of renunciation of letting go that's needed. Letting go of the tendency of the mind to go into the future, into the past. That willingness to relinquish, even for a few moments, to connect with this present moment. Think about some of the upcoming things that you might be concerned about in your life. If you're not thinking about them, where are they? If you're not maintaining that worry with thought, there's just this present moment, or just what's present right here. There's also this shift from moving into thought, into concept, into intellect, into the heart, in a sense of the heart opening to whatever is here, a sense of quivering of the heart with the compassion that's needed to meet this moment, and shifting from thought into the sense data, the sense of smell, the sense of touch, of sight, of sound, of sensation. And in that way, it's a profound way of shifting from the reactivity, the lostness and contraction of mind, into this presentness. And especially if the mind is tight, the mind is tired, is contracted, noticing what is actually pleasant in this moment, what is actually comfortable and easy. Noticing how the mindfulness then naturally starts to relax with that, starts to open and become more and more receptive. And from that place of receptivity, then the stillness starts to arise. And the more we start to abide in that stillness, then that gladdening of the mind takes a whole different expression. Actually, see, this is a much more natural state of being than our contraction. Like we're literally waking up from this dream of being lost in thought. Just seeing this moment, this breath, this sensation. And as we relax deeper and deeper into that moment, we recognize it's actually our true abide, our true abode, our true home, regardless of where we might be physically. In Soto, in the U District, at home, at work, with our families, with our parents, our grandparents. We find that there's this universality that's always accessible, and we're just willing to listen. In this way, the mind is naturally gladdened, naturally light. All right, thank you. Let's just sit quietly for a few moments.